The title of this exhibit and the book is Unembedded, Four Independent Photojournalists on the War in Iraq. Just some explanation on what that means. It's fairly self-explanatory. I mean, the unembedded part simply means that we, instead of, rather than photographing with the American forces, traveling with them, using their protection to move throughout Iraq, we chose to travel independently, to travel with just Iraqi people using local sources, local guides, not wearing body armor. And it changes the perspective that you get and the perspective that then you're able to show. Now, the independent part, a lot of people will get that confused. The word that gets tossed around all the time now is mainstream media, and a lot of people assume that means we don't work for the mainstream media, but that's not true. In fact, if we didn't have mainstream media, we wouldn't be able to do any of this work. We've, as Wendy has said, you know, we've worked for as mainstream as they come. We work for the New York Times, we work for Time and Newsweek, and a collection of newspapers, both European and American. And we have sort of a love-hate relationship with that, or I can speak for myself. I have kind of a love-hate relationship. On the one hand, these, we need them. We need the income that we get in order to do the work that we do, and they reach a lot of people. If you get a picture published in Time magazine, that photograph is going to be seen by approximately 16 million people. And if you really care about getting your work out, that's a great thing. That's the love part of the relationship. On the other hand, you can find yourself working on a story and something that feels very viscerally important to you. And when, at the end of the week, when you turn to the newsstands looking for that... looking for the magazine that's supposed to tell you what's important in the world, you end up with things like this. That's the other half of the sort of love-hate relationship, and I hope there's no one here who works for Time, and I mean this in good spirits, and please don't, you know, kick me off of future assignments. And, you know, and it's not, I'm not just cherry picking, you know, I could go on and on and on, and and we're all familiar with these things. And occasionally they do, however, get down to really serious issues, such as this, losing Afghanistan. This is something very, very challenging. You know, they have a delicate balance to tread as well. The people who edit these magazines, they care about these stories, but they need, you know, need to keep the magazine alive. They need to sell copies so that they can get income, so they can afford to hire people working in these far-flung places, so that they can tell important stories as well. And this was a very difficult one, this, to put this on the cover of an American magazine. Are we losing Afghanistan? That's a very difficult question to ask a country that's still really sensitized about issues of war, particularly the war on terrorism, and Afghanistan in particular, because it's so connected with 9/11. And so I applaud them for, you know, taking risks like this to ask these important questions. Now, you may not recognize this this cover, and I wouldn't blame you, because unless you live in Europe, Asia, or Latin America, you would have seen a different cover. In the United States, this is what we had in that month. And I bring that up just to say that the news that we get here in the United States is not necessarily what you would get outside the United States, even from the same sources. I lived for 10 years in Europe, and when I came here and I turned on CNN, it was quite a foreign thing to me, because CNN domestic and CNN international are very, very different news organizations. I don't mean to imply anything sinister here, because, you know, Newsweek has, you know, a delicate balance, as does Time. I have no idea how much they had invested in Annie Leibovitz pictures, but I'm sure it was a lot of money to run them on the in the magazine. She probably had a limited time period that they could run them, and they got backed into a corner. I just bring it up to say that we have to remember that what we see here and what the rest of the world sees about the United States is often very different. Now, I became interested in Iraq shortly after 9/11, when I started to understand right away that the United States was probably going to become involved in Iraq in a far more aggressive way than they already had. So I started trying to get into Iraq. And I didn't really know much about the country. I first went there in 2002, before this invasion. And I knew that there is, you know, this sort of evil dictator, Saddam Hussein, and I knew that the United States had been at war in 1991 and had invaded. But that's not that's about all that I knew. And when I got there, I found something that really startled me. I mean, I found a country much richer than I had imagined. I think it's this obsessive focus on Saddam Hussein, even for me as a journalist, had really narrowed my view of what the country might be like. And I remember getting there. This is one of the first photographs that I took. I was terrified to go out in the streets, and so I stayed in the lobby of the hotel for a day or two, and there was a wedding. And I started seeing normal life, and gradually I began to explore. This is my favorite domino parlor. I used to go there and play dominoes and drink tea and get totally high on caffeine until like 2 or 3 in the morning. And every time when I came out, the security guard was sleeping like this. And it wasn't like that later, of course, but this is, you know, before the invasion. And Iraq was a really claustrophobic place. You know, living in a dictatorship is a really strange experience. It was relatively, let's say, safer than it is now. If you play by the rules, you know, then everything is okay. But the rules are very, very strict, and so you do feel stifled. It feels like you can't take deep breaths. But I discovered that, you know, the United States really was still at war in Iraq, and that they had been bombing continuously since that first Gulf War. This is a girl in the Shiite South, in an area that where the United States had established what they called no-fly zones, that probably better should have been called we-fly zones, because we flew and we bombed frequently from 1991 until the invasion in 2003. And in fact, today, you know, the United States still conducts bombing raids in Iraq. Those bombing raids intensified a lot in 2002 and 3 in the run-up to this invasion. And this was a girl who lost her arm in one of those bombings. These were the Shia of the South, who were ostensibly the people the no-fly zones were set up to protect. I have no reason to put this picture in, just because I love it, basically. It was a movie theater. You know, this is during the time we're sort of waiting for the invasion to come, and there just wasn't this big, massive buildup of military in Baghdad that you might have expected. And, you know, this, I was just wandering around, just taking the temperature on the streets, and there's this this guy at a movie theater, and that guy behind him is the governor of California, of course. This is one of the people that I met early in my time in Iraq. His name was Sheikh Fuad, and he was the imam of a Sunni mosque in what is now the Green Zone. So this, even before this invasion, the Green Zone was an area that was very important to the center of government. It's where Saddam Hussein had his most important palaces, and a lot of the most important ministries were located. So to be the imam of that mosque was a very, very important position. And I met this guy, and he just—I didn't know how to understand him. He, you know, his hair, his beard was dyed blonde. He wore lipstick and mascara. He dressed in the style, he said, of the Virgin Mary. He said he loved Mariah Carey. She sings with the voice of an angel. Gave me tips on using yogurt to keep my skin young. And I just didn't know how to place this character in my head. And I realized, you know, there's a place for this person in this society, and this is just when I thought I had this place pegged. You know, you meet someone like this, and you realize that it's a far more complicated place than you first allowed yourself to believe. But the big thing for me in Iraq was that I discovered the effects of the sanctions, and to this day, I'm really horrified about that period of American foreign policy history. If you'll remember, after the first Gulf War, the United Nations imposed a sanctions regime on Iraq in which Iraq was prevented from importing certain goods into the country that might conceivably be used as a weapon of mass destruction. There was a committee in the UN called the 501 Committee, which was almost completely dominated by the United States representation. Some 98% of the restrictions were at the insistence of our government. And the restrictions were really broadly interpreted so that for some time incubators were not allowed imported into Iraq. A lot of radiological treatment for treating cancers were not allowed to be imported into Iraq. Chlorine was not allowed to be imported into Iraq, into a country which relied almost exclusively on chlorine for treating contaminated water to make it safe for drinking. So you can imagine the effects that this had, that UNHCR estimated in a study that they did over a 10-year period that during that 10 years, Iraq had seen an excess of 500,000 deaths of children under the age of five. Children, only children under the age of five, 500,000 in excess of our expectations during that period as a result of the sanctions regime. And that's something that was really visible in Iraq at that time. It was clear to see that the country was suffering. And I was shocked that I didn't know more about it already. Such a huge story. And as a journalist, someone who reads the news a lot, I didn't know more about it. And that's sort of what sucked me in. And that was the first story that I latched onto in Iraq. I didn't understand why we didn't know what was happening in Iraq when it was so directly related to our foreign policy. This is one of those 500,000 children. It's a young boy who I photographed after he'd been through a circumcision, and it was discovered then that he had a disorder that would not allow his blood to clot. Now, in most countries of the world, this is very easy to treat. There's a simple blood coagulant that can be administered that will allow him his blood to clot. He can stop the bleeding, and he can continue to take this drug throughout his life and live a relatively normal life. But in Iraq, that drug was prohibited from import through the 501 committee at the United States government's insistence. So as a result, I'm standing in this hospital room, and I knew he was going to die. The doctor knew he was going to die. And this young mother, who must have been 16, I don't know, she knew he was going to die. And the doctor just administered some sort of experimental drug, he called it, but he confessed to me that it was just a saline solution to try and, you know, mitigate the pain. And it just really struck me that large number reduced to this tragic event in front of me. And a lot of people often ask me, you know, when they find out when I'm a photojournalist, they say, if you know, the guy who's sitting next to you on the airport in the airplane, he says something like, "What's the most horrible thing that you've ever seen or photographed?" And I think they're expecting me to talk about severed limbs. But I have to say that, you know, this is really one of the most horrible experiences that I've been through as a photographer. But it is really, if I could pick a single moment, this is the moment that committed me to following this story. So for me, covering the Iraq at that time was really about these people, about the people that I was being introduced to. And yet this is what we were seeing on the newsstands, this sort of obsessive focus on this almost cartoonish character of the monster of Saddam Hussein. And of course there's a grain of truth in this. I mean, Saddam was a terrible dictator and made a lot of horrible decisions and put the civilian population of his country at risk. But I think that's such a narrow focus for us, and we weren't getting complete coverage. And that's, you know, you could see just again, one after another, it was just one after another, the country of Iraq was reduced to a single figure. And this was the sort of culmination of that. By the way, I did some, when I was researching the pictures, you know, for Time magazine, I was going through to see all these covers. I came up with this one, and it looked familiar. This is from 2003, and when I looked further, I found this one from 1945. I think they're trying to make some sort of subtle point, but does everybody get it? I'm just kidding. So, I mean, that was the face of Iraq, this Saddam Hussein in our public, in our biggest mainstream media. And yet this was the face of Iraq to me. Remember that phrase for the fourth largest army in the world? Well, this is what it looked like, and this is what I was seeing at the time. And I just, that discrepancy kept coming up for me. And I think it's important for us to look back on this. A lot of people say, why do you keep going over this? This is 5 years ago. And I think it's important for us to do that, because we forget really quickly. And there's so many similarities. I mean, when I found this cover, what war with Iran would look like. As a photographer, I mean, I said, that's exactly the problem. That was exactly the problem before. Is this what it's going to look like? Are we still going to obsessively focus on our cartoon villains? Or are we really going to see in future conflicts a real picture of the people who live in these countries? So those are the, you know, I bring all of that to you to say those are the kinds of motivations that I brought to it, and I think a lot, all four of us shared these similar frustrations with how the war was covered, and we decided that we needed to bring, come together with a publication and exhibit from another point of view. And one that we started off not thinking embedded or unembedded, but at least it would have the focus on Iraqi people themselves. That was our initial impulse, and that's where we started with this. So I'm gonna turn it over to Cale here to talk about what happened, because we were both in Baghdad when the bombs first started falling. Unfortunately, I couldn't stay. I was detained by the Iraqi securities, the Mukhabarat, and kicked out of the country, but Cale stayed on. So I'm going to turn it over here to her, and I'll use this Time Magazine front page on the website as a sort of segue here. And just again, I just want to point out this Saddam under siege. You know, we were in Baghdad at the time, and to us it didn't feel like Saddam under siege. It felt like, you know, Iraq under siege. It was, you know, 26 million people or 28 million people, depending on whose census you read. So I use that as a segue and to let Cale talk about her experiences. I'm gonna come back several times, and if you clap every time, it's gonna make me really embarrassed. So.
Yeah, he'll be back. He has more to say. So I first went to Iraq. I'll just give you a little bit of background about how I came to be there. I first went in 2003, just before the bombing began, the bombing of Baghdad for this round of conflict with Iraq. I went 3 weeks before the bombing began because I had a very short-term visa, and I wanted to be sure to be in Baghdad when this military campaign ensued so that I could have the perspective that that Iraqis would have when this war began. So I really wanted to see what that was like to be in Baghdad during that time and to document it as well as I could. So I stayed 3 months from the 3 months before the bombing began. I stayed for another 2.5 months after it began, was there for those 3 weeks. All journalists were required to stay in one hotel, in the Palestine Hotel, so that's where I stayed. And during that time, I really felt it was important to show what the violence looked like on the ground as best I could, because I knew that for embedded photographers traveling with the U.S. military, and there were some 600 journalists traveling with the U.S. military, and there were only a couple of hundred journalists in Baghdad, I knew that the invasion part on the ground wouldn't look very, would be fairly bloodless, that we wouldn't be seeing images of American casualties much and probably not civilian casualties. What embedded photographers would show us was what the desert looked like mostly and what soldiers looked like on the road to Baghdad. But in Baghdad itself, during the bombing campaign, there were significant numbers of civilian casualties. People who, you know, though this was supposedly a well-targeted war, and was, for modern standards, a fairly specifically targeted bombing campaign, Iraqis' houses, people living on the outskirts near military installations or the Republican Guard who made a ring around Baghdad in those final days, those positions were very close to civilians, and civilian houses there were very fragile. So if a bomb landed nearby a home, it would often collapse on the people inside, or shrapnel would come flying through the windows and kill people in their yards, or, you know, hiding in their bedrooms. And the civilians coming into the hospitals in Baghdad were really very significant numbers, and the doctors were fairly overwhelmed with the number of casualties. So I spent a lot of time in hospitals during those 3 weeks of the bombing campaign. This is a photograph actually from one of the very last days of that battle for Baghdad. The Americans had already arrived in Baghdad, and all of the hospitals had been looted because the hospitals weren't secured, neither were the museums or any of the civilian infrastructure. The hospitals were one of the first things to be looted, so the only place to treat people was one major trauma center left called the Saddam City Medical Center, and it was overflowing. I mean, there were people in the lobbies, there were people in the hallways, and this is a makeshift triage room in the lobby of that hospital. They tried to save a man who was injured in a looting, and they used a lot of blood trying to save him, but he didn't survive. And during these bombings, this photograph now is from before the Americans arrived to Baghdad. During these bombings, sometimes a missile would go astray and land in a marketplace and a crowded public area. This is from a market bombing. A bomb landed in a suburb of Baghdad and killed some 50-odd people. Many of them were children. There's an 8-year-old girl who was killed by a piece of shrapnel in that bombing. One of the questions that people sometimes ask, and in among journalists there in Baghdad, one of the concerns was that, well, perhaps Iraqis would sabotage their own people and kill them and take us to the sites and ask us to photograph it, which is one of these myth scenarios, or one of these scenarios that comes off very often in wartime. I've heard this, it rang a bell for me, I heard this in Sarajevo. The Serbs would sometimes say, oh, the Bosnians are bombing themselves just to get the sympathy of the world. And so that was one of the claims during this time, or one of the concerns. Journalists were saying, well, maybe that market bombing was really by the Iraqis. And then the U.S. military also suggested perhaps it was an anti-aircraft missile that went astray and landed on Iraq's own people. But one journalist did track this down, Robert Fisk, and he traced a piece of the bomb fragment from the site to Lockheed Martin. This is another scene from a hospital during the bombing. I wanted to tell some individual stories, so I saw this one family. This man had a particularly harrowing story. He carried one of his dead children into the hospital. His neighbor carried another small child who was killed in his front yard when fragments of bomb landed in his front yard, some shrapnel. And his wife was also badly injured. And she walked into the hospital with her son, but later was so badly injured that she couldn't be treated. And they had to move on to other patients who the doctors thought they could save. So this boy and his father watched the wife of the family die, and two of his other children were killed. So that's one family whose life is, you know, altered forever. And so I saw a range of expressions among Iraqis. I didn't only see, because I was in Iraq during the bombing, I didn't only see celebration and joy with the arrival of the U.S. forces. I saw a lot of death and destruction and anger and frustration and sorrow. That's what I witnessed. And so this is a photograph of one of these angry moments. This is a crowd demonstrating in front of a U.S. Army barracks. The U.S. military was guarding an arms dump. They'd been collecting weapons from this one suburb of Baghdad. And there was an accident at the site, and one of the missiles at the arms dump launched itself into a nearby village and killed a family. While they're having lunch, killed several members of the family. So this is an angry mob that came from that village to protest peacefully, actually, in front of this army barracks. And I'm standing between the U.S. soldiers behind me and this angry crowd. So in those final days before the Americans arrived, there were these sort of shows of force by the Iraqi government. This is a car full of National Guardsmen who paraded past our hotel saying, you know, they were going to fight to the end. They quickly disappeared after the Americans arrived in Baghdad. There wasn't much of a fight for Baghdad. There wasn't much they could do at that point. And then this is a scene that became memorialized, I think, for many Americans and became symbolic of the moment when Baghdad fell and we won the war. And I could see this scene unfolding outside of my hotel in Iraq. And at this point, I was so frustrated with what I knew was going to be the story at home, the narrative arc of this story. I could barely even make these photographs. It just seemed to me such a staged and insincere moment. It wasn't really the end of the war. I could see that. It was very clear to me. But this scene became very popular, the moment that the statue was pulled down in Firdos Square. But there were also other moments of demonstration in the same square. Here's one of them. And this is one of those moments of relief. And the wonderful thing about being a journalist is that you get exposed to the wide range of human experience. You see massive amounts of tragedy, but also a lot of humor and irony and more humane moments. And I just thought this was one of those funny moments with this small picture of Saddam dressed like a Dracula, Darth Vader ninja down in the corner of this poster.
Maybe Elvis, too.
A little. Maybe Elvis, I don't know, but this is supposed to read Bush plus, you know, Saddam. This is the same thing, Bush and Saddam in this man's mind. This is, you know, clearly a political expression. And that's, you know, Bush, not the German appliance company. So soon after Baghdad fell, I had the opportunity to spend time in Anbar province with a member of the Dulaimi tribe, this very large tribe of Sunni, a Sunni family in Anbar province. And they took me into their home. I had met these people through the writer I was working with at the time, and my translator's family was actually this sheikh. It was his uncle. So I wanted to see traditional Iraqi life, and immediately after the invasion, there was a small moment of relief when suddenly we could travel at every place. I could go into any Iraqi's home. I could speak to anybody. This hadn't been possible under the regime. I couldn't speak freely or travel freely. No one could. And so this was my opportunity to see the real Iraq, to see what it looked like once the regime was missing. And so I spent a lot of time with this family here. They fed me, and I would stay with them for a couple of weeks at a time. I met the sheikh. This is the sheikh. And he was a fairly Western-looking man. He was a businessman. I mean, Western looking in that he had a very broad mind, this person. He was ready to do business with the Americans, and he talked to us about business opportunities that might be possible with the Americans in place. He had a large construction company that built roads and infrastructure for schools. This is his home. I would stay with the women. It's a very segregated environment, a very traditional environment. The men and the women live in separate parts of the household. So it was very unusual when I had the opportunity to swim with the Delamy cousins in their underwear in the Euphrates River. This would not have been something that Iraqi women would do, but I got to spend some really relaxing time with this family.
Can you just clarify that you weren't also...
I was not also in my underwear. I was wearing a long black abaya and holding a camera, and I did swim in this long nylon, you know, very traditional piece of clothing that nearly drowned me. I don't recommend trying to swim in one. The girls would go elsewhere, separate from the boys, and swim, but I was with the boys, so I was in the abaya. And at this time, I was traveling around Fallujah and Ramadi, and this is some of the graffiti on the wall of the police station in Fallujah: "I love you, Iraq and USA." And I was sort of shocked to see this kind of support of optimism at that time, because I wasn't personally very optimistic, but some people there were optimistic. And above that, it says, "Absolutely no parking." I think I had someone translate it for me a couple of times now. But very early on, there were signs that things weren't going to go smoothly, and one of them was this incident in Fallujah where there were U.S. soldiers housed in a public school, and they were using that temporarily as their base. And there were a group of protesters who gathered in the town to protest that the Americans were in the school. They wanted the school back so they could start classes again. And they didn't really like the Americans hanging out in their town, having a base like this and sort of checking things out and going door to door. It really broke many social codes for Fallujah. And so there was an incident where this protest that arrived at the school, someone opened fire. There's no one's quite sure who opened fire first, but at the end of this violent confrontation, there were 13 protesters dead, and no Americans were killed in that protest. But the school building didn't really have scars of bullet marks. It was largely the Americans firing into the crowd. And that really turned the tide in Fallujah. It changed a lot of people's minds. And it was an important event. It was small, only 13 people killed in a small town in Iraq. But this was Fallujah, and it was a symbolic place, a place of a lot of independence. It was a holy city. It was called the City of Mosques, because it was seen as sort of a holy sanctuary for Islam among the Sunni tribes people. And so this one incident, I could feel overnight, I could feel the temperature change in this city. And people looked at me differently. They were anxious. I went to this hospital, and people were angry. You know, this is a flag that they'd wrapped some of the people killed at the protests. They'd wrapped them in this flag and taken them to the hospital. And so the tribes people, they came together, these representatives of the families in Fallujah got together and discussed, well, what will be done? You know, the Americans have killed these people. And the way it works in the tribal code is that if someone's killed, there should be some kind of compensation by the other side, the other party, the guilty party. And they were discussing whether or not that would be possible to strike something like that with the Americans. And the leaders were really talking about this in order to keep the population under control and from getting too angry over the incident. And I think there were some payments made at this time, but I'm not clear exactly what they were. So I returned to Iraq then. I went home and returned some months later in the fall of the same year, and I went back to Fallujah to see this family, this sheikh, and stay with the family. And by this time, the resistance movement was well underway. There had been attacks on the roads in Fallujah between Fallujah and Ramadi and Baghdad, attacks against U.S. troops since really April 2003. Already in April 2003, there were attacks against the U.S. But that story was not really given much credibility in the U.S. media. But in the graffiti on the walls by October, I could see things had really shifted.
So the incident that Cale talked about, that first incident in Fallujah, around that same period of time, a lot of things started happening repeatedly in small doses here and there. A family would approach a checkpoint too quickly. The people guarding the checkpoint would fire into the car and, you know, through accidentally kill innocent people. There was this cycle of revenge where the families who had members killed at a checkpoint would then attack American troops. That would cause reprisals, attacks and reprisals, and it started spinning out of control. From what we could tell by following the news in the U.S., I don't think that was really reported very well here. I think it was, we heard a lot of the insurgency being in its last throes and the dead enders and all. This is that period of time that we're talking about. But in fact, the insurgency started very, very early, as Cale mentioned. This is a victim of one of the bombings in a village against a suspected site of an insurgents. And in fact, it turned out just to be a family living next door to where the insurgent had been living. And so a lot of members of his family were killed. This boy's father was killed. He doesn't know it yet. And the doctor is just holding up an x-ray to show the wounds to his family. So about that time, you know, several of us then started looking to find who these insurgents were. And it was actually really difficult to get some of these pictures published. And Cale actually has more experience with that than I did because she had even better experience doing a deep story on the Sunni insurgency. And it was kind of hard to sell that story because it didn't fit in the narrative that people had, our editors here. You know, we had this narrative preconceived that this was a war of liberation, that we were going to come in and we'd be greeted with flowers and people would be, you know, throw off the chains of dictatorship and there was the happy ending. And we constructed that narrative with our, you know, rosy glasses looking backwards at France and the liberation of France in World War II. And you would often hear these kinds of references. And as a result, we would, those of us who were covering the insurgency at that time actually didn't get our stories published very easily because it didn't fit what people expected. Or at least that's how I feel. I'm speaking from a personal perspective. I don't really have a statistical study to back that up. This is just my anecdotal evidence. Well, this is one of the first insurgents that I was able to meet and photograph, and I photographed him up in the north and near Tal Afar. He basically constructed this. I was a little nervous. I'll be honest. This is the first insurgent that I was there for in his presence, and he wanted his picture taken, and I said, okay, here I am to take your picture. He constructed the whole thing. He's the guy with the gun, so I said, do whatever you want. His mother insisted on being in the picture. She said, we want the world to know that that mothers support their sons in resisting occupation. So she insisted on being in there. And then at the last minute, just when everything gets all set up, and again, you know, I don't know this guy. We had a contact, friend of a friend of a friend who got us there. At the last minute, he says, wait a minute. And he goes out and he comes back with this thing. And that makes me a little nervous. I took his picture and I started talking to him. And somewhere he had heard, I don't know how, he lives up in this tiny little village that didn't even have electricity at the time, but somehow he could quote something that Donald Rumsfeld had said. I don't even know how he knew who Donald Rumsfeld was. But he quoted something that he had heard from Donald Rumsfeld saying that most of the people fighting against the Americans were foreigners. And he insisted on holding this, which is an instrument that local Iraqi date farmers use in picking dates. So he insisted on holding that to say, look, I'm an Iraqi. I'm just a farmer. I'm fighting for my homeland. I'm not Al-Qaeda. I'm not a foreign terrorist. So I think in his mind, he was trying to sort of soften the image. And I'm not sure. I was really, really relieved when he told me that explanation. But I don't think it really works. It doesn't really cross the cultural divide. But, you know, this cycle of attack and reprisal, this is actually one of Cale's photographs, which I stuck in here because it helps in my narrative here. This attack and reprisal cycle really started to pick up. And one of the things that we would see is if there was a roadside bomb in which an American vehicle was attacked, suddenly, you know, civilians would come out of the woodwork to come and check it out. I mean, there are no bowling alleys operating. There's no movie theaters. That's what's going on. And there's also a lot of anger in the Sunni triangle about the invasion, about the bombing. And so, there, you know, sometimes people would celebrate, and this would often end really, really badly. Haith Abdullahad is an Iraqi photographer who contributed to this exhibit and to the book. He's a really incredible person. And was not a journalist before this invasion, but very quickly became one of the best journalists in Iraq. This is a sequence that's illustrated in the exhibit outside that he photographed. He heard about an incident on Haifa Street, which is a very sort of fundamentalist Sunni area of Baghdad. And he heard that one of these American vehicles had been attacked and was on fire. That's the smoke you see in the background. So, you know, as a journalist, where there's smoke, there's got to be fire. So he starts running towards the smoke. And when he got there, he found the vehicle that had been attacked. There was a crowd of civilians had gathered around. Probably the people who originally attacked it are long gone. But there was a very large crowd of civilians who gathered around. Some of them were celebrating. And these two helicopters, American helicopters, which unfortunately you can't see. I can see it on my screen, but it's you can't see it up there. There's a helicopter in the sky just off to the right side. These two American helicopters came and fired rockets down into that crowd. Now, their explanation from the military point of view, what they said later after the fact, was that they sought to disable the vehicle, which, but in the process, about two dozen people were killed through several rocket attacks and some gunfire from the helicopters. Haith himself was trapped with another group of civilians and journalists, and in fact, in the place where he was hiding, the other five people he was hiding with were killed, and Haith himself was injured. But he was basically forced to sit there and watch this unfold over a 45-minute period. He couldn't move, and so these are the scenes that he photographed out of that experience. This was another sort of marquee moment, you know, when you know, this crowd, some of them young children. This is one of the journalists who was with Haith. He was also killed. At this point, he's calling for help, but it didn't come fast enough for him. That's the vehicle in the background. I just want to say one thing. I think a lot of we debated a lot about some of the more graphic pictures for our show tonight and for the exhibit and for the book. I think a lot of times people often ask, why don't we see more of these kinds of pictures? I think there's a lot of reasons. One of the reasons is it's very dangerous to take those kinds of pictures. And I really appreciate that Haith was able to continue to work under dangerous circumstances. There are a host of other reasons, but the main reason is that it's in those circumstances, it's not easy to be there as a photographer and to take the picture.
So this is a little moment of reprieve after some of those difficult images, but ironically, it's beautiful as it is. It's a burning, it's an attack on a, it was a sabotaged oil pipeline near Fallujah, or perhaps an oil depot station. I don't know exactly what it was, but it was burning oil and something you saw very frequently in Iraq as these sabotage attempts were frequent. So, you know, we've been telling you about the many limitations of working for the U.S. media, and I think many of them, it's market-driven largely, and we can maybe talk more about that later in the question and answer period. But what I really wanted to stress was that, you know, our beef is that it's difficult to get these stories published from a ground-level point of view, and it's difficult to tell individual stories about shifts in the society and really what things are changing in Iraq on the ground, because it really flies in the face with the policy that was supported all these years during the war, the policy that was put forward in our name. So it was very difficult to get stories published. But that said, there are editors trying very hard to give their readers insight into what was changing in Iraq, one magazine story at a time. And this was one story that was assigned to me by an editor at U.S. News and World Report, and it was about the change of ability of women to live and move freely in Iraq, because there had been there was a movement growing by the end of 2004 of reprisals towards women for any sort of inappropriate behavior by these militia groups that were developing, particularly the Sadr militia in Sadr City. So women were getting threatened for not covering their heads. They were being told that they couldn't go to school or go to university classes. Girls were being kidnapped at an alarming rate, mostly for ransom, from wealthy families so that girls were afraid to go outside. Particularly women were kidnapped because the families would pay more for their daughters to get their daughters back, since any daughter who has been kidnapped, might her reputation might be tarnished because no one knows what happened to her while she was kidnapped. So it would be harder for her later to get married. That was one of the concerns for people. And so I did the story about Iraqi women, and these are the last days I was working in Iraq. And at the end of 2004, things were getting increasingly difficult. It was harder to move around. And these women are on their way to a henna party. They're outside of a beauty salon. A henna party is like a bridal shower in Iraq. So they're on their way to a henna party, and they're wearing makeup, which is something they don't want to be seen doing on the street. So they're in the back of this dark car with the tinted windows up, and when they saw me out there with my camera, they sort of, you know, they pushed the button and the window came down. There were these smiling faces, and it was a really nice moment. I made this photograph. And the women inside the beauty salon were shockingly honest about how life was changing for them and about lots of other things I never thought I would get to hear about in Iraq, like, you know, everything from birth control to, you know, what they liked their husbands to do, and it was really interesting. Yes, women, people all over the world have similar concerns. And so these women, it was really some of the nicest time I got to spend in Iraq, because I had this window into daily life there. But these beauty salons, they were really one of these little islands of reprieve. These are girls, university students at Baghdad University, who I was able to photograph for this story. But by this time, girls were so terrified about appearing in the Western media, afraid something bad would happen to them as a result. Maybe they would be kidnapped or they'd be singled out in their neighborhood by a militia group. I couldn't find any young women, Western-looking women like this, who wanted to be photographed by me. It was so difficult. They were on the streets, you know, in some neighborhoods that were relatively safer than others, like Karada, but they didn't want to be photographed because they were so afraid. So these girls agreed to meet me at a cafe, and I made their photograph there. I met them through my translator. And already these girls are having a difficult time going to school because there are posters put up by militia groups saying girls shouldn't be in school or they should be wearing head coverings and more conservative clothes. And this is one of those beauty salons in Sadr City. These would sometimes be attacked for having, first threatened and sometimes attacked, to be made examples of, for having images like this in the window, advertisements of women with makeup and more Western looking. Or, I don't know, secular looking, I would say. And it was interesting to watch these things unfold and the different dimensions of identity shift for women in Iraq at that time. These women are loosely members of the Sadr militia. So this is Muqtada al-Sadr's group, a very conservative Shia group that grew in political power. And we were able to make some contacts with this militia group and have some access to the inner workings of the organization. And so these women are posing here with Muqtada al-Sadr in this very conservative dress that they tell me during the time of Saddam they would have been afraid to wear because it singles them out as very pious Shia women. And that could have meant that they were enemies of the state, since many of the resistance groups against the regime, many of the opposition groups against the regime were Shia. So that's who we were supporting at the time. So for them, this is their expression of freedom. They get to wear their conservative clothing now and walk the streets freely. So at different parts of the city, there are these conflicting experiences, these very different experiences. And these women are also telling me they would love to learn to fight. They would like to be allowed to fight with the men in the Sadr militia group, and that would be their cause, their support of the anti-occupation movement. This is what they called it, their support of the resistance movement. They didn't fight, though. They mostly provided support, food, and support for the Sadr militia. And we really felt it was important to get inside of these groups, if possible, and reveal their motivations and their thinking. And if they were willing to share with us, you know, it seemed to us that it would be really valuable information for the American public to hear when understanding and parsing the rhetoric coming out of Washington. Here's another of these salient moments for me when I got some insight into what was changing in Iraq. And these children are celebrating, reenacting the death of the first Shia martyr at the hands of U.S. forces in Sadr City. And I had just come from Lebanon. Before I was in Iraq, I spent some time in Lebanon. So I'd spent some time with Hezbollah, and I spent some time with other movements in Israel and Palestine. And I was watching this myth creating these, this new identity evolve for these children, that now they understood and they're learning in this religious school that, you know, it's the Americans versus us. It's us versus the West. And this was a concept that would not really necessarily have been the way they would see the world. It didn't have to be that way. But they are reenacting the death of this martyr, and I could just see the seeds of this new, potentially, you know, explosive conflict between these two countries. It's just very sad.
For the last portion here, we're going to want to talk about specifically about the Mehdi army, and just as an illustration of how a foreign policy can interact with a culture that we don't understand and predict and produce results that we don't predict, even though they may be predictable results. This is a photograph one of the first photographs I took after, as I mentioned, I was kicked out of Iraq during the bombing. When the border guards fled, I was able to come back in. And this is one of the first photographs that I made. It's a mosque inside Sadr City, where people are coming for medicines. Just to provide some context, we're going back to the invasion now. When I came back in a convoy of journalists into Baghdad, it wasn't completely under control, and arguably still isn't. But when I came back in with this convoy, we kept running into firefights, so we'd have to turn and go to a different neighborhood, trying to get to the Palestine Hotel, which we knew was a secure area. So along the way, I got to see a lot of Baghdad. I saw, for example, the Al-Kindi Hospital, which is Baghdad's primary traumatic care treatment facility. It's where you would go if you're in a car accident, if you have that kind of trauma. But there was no protection there. During the invasion, there was no plan to protect the hospital from looters and from the chaos that overtook Baghdad. So I saw the hospital beds just, you know, coming out. I saw people taking oxygen tanks, you know, anything that they thought that they might be able to use to survive in the next period or to sell to help them survive in the next period. There was a lot of looting going on. And I knew what that Al-Kindi Hospital was supposed to be doing at this precise moment when so many people had just been through the bombing and needed that hospital. It broke my heart to see that happening. A few blocks away, I also passed by the oil ministry, the Ministry of Oil, which is an office building. And it was surrounded by 13 armored vehicles, Bradley fighting vehicles and tanks. And the contrast of that hospital and this office building, and one being so overprotected and one not protected at all, really made an impression on me. Meanwhile, in Sadr City, and this is maybe a day later, all the people who needed health and treatment, there were no, you know, first aid stations set up by the international community or by the American soldiers. There was nothing like that. But for weeks already in Sadr City, they had been planning for this moment. And they followed a very Hezbollah-style strategy to provide social services for people. And that, of course, you know, contracted their loyalty. And later on, when it became to a conflict between the leaders of Sadr City and the American forces there, then it developed into the Mehdi Army. The Mehdi Army is a private militia, as most people probably know, of Muqtada al-Sadr, who is a junior cleric in Iraq. His father was a very important cleric and a learned scholar, as was his grandfather and his uncle. They had held correspondence with Bertrand Russell. They came from a very learned tradition. Muqtada himself was not so well educated. He was young, but as the heir of that family that had been persecuted under Saddam, he sort of took on the mantle of importance. And this militia he formed was called the Mehdi Army. It was very much a sort of grassroots organization. This is Kale and I, and Haith and Rita, all four of us, were able to photograph the early stages of the development of the Mehdi Army, and we were able to follow them through some of what went on. As I mentioned, they were connected to that earlier group of people that was handing out the medicines, building that social network. Then they became a military force. Ironically, a lot of these people had been previously persecuted by Saddam and had been imprisoned in political prisons. And for some stupid reason, in Saddam's regime, they had taken all these political prisoners and put them in the same room where they could organize to fight, you know, one day come out and form a militia. They thought they were going to fight Saddam, but they ended up fighting the Americans when they invaded. You can see the tattoo he has on his arm. That was a tattoo he got in prison. These two brothers who we came to know showed us photographs of the time when they were in prison, when they organized. You know, gradually through these contacts, these people that we got to know, we were allowed to go into the areas that the Mehdi army controlled, and we could see them, the defenses that they set up against incursions in their neighborhoods. This is how one of the ways that they would lay bombs in the road. This is this is a troubling picture. I mean, they're actually laying IEDs in the road. You know, IEDs, the improvised explosive device. They melt the tarmac and then they bury these artillery shells underneath, which then they can explode by remote control. You know, this is a controversial photograph and among some of the others that we have here. And we sometimes get a lot of flack for this. Just make it clear, you know, none of the photographers here are members of the Mehdi Army. We don't contribute any material support or any logistical support or any intelligence. We're you know, third-party observers. And I think it's important for us to see what it looks like on the other sides of the line. So we feel like we're contributing to the dialogue, an important dialogue in understanding this war a little deeper. Now, this Mehdi army started very small, and they were poor. They came from Sadr City, the poorest area, and they came into conflict with the Americans, and it quickly spun out of control and turned into a major confrontation. And here's an example of unpredictable results in spite of of having a policy that produces results that you don't predict, even though they may be predictable. This conflict, the Mehdi army fighting the Americans, both sides decided, you know, we're not going to be negotiating. We're just going to go full out and fight. They had had, you know, little battles here and there, and now this is the first major full-on confrontation between the two armies. The Mehdi army, for their own reasons, strategic reasons, moved the center of the conflict to Najaf. And they hold themselves up inside the Imam Ali shrine, which was the most important shrine in Shiite Islam. It's like the Vatican of Shiite Islam. And the Americans set up what they called a ring of steel around it and besieged the old city of Najaf for three weeks. They bombed with 2,000-pound bombs. They used tanks. They used mortars. They used artillery, snipers. Both sides poured everything out there. What you need to understand is that Najaf is the, as I said, the sort of center of Shiite Islam. The Iraqi government and the American army were both considering storming the shrine, which would have had really devastating consequences to the relationship between Shiite Islam and the West for decades, for generations to come. Thankfully, they never actually stormed the shrine. The Imam Ali is one of the most revered imams in Shiite Islam. It's basically, he's the first imam of Shiite Islam. It was his death, his martyrdom, which caused the split between Sunni and Shia. So Shiite Islam is largely organized around the very idea of martyrdom. And this is, herein lies the rub. When you go to battle, when you choose to confront with full military fight an army that's organized around the principle of martyrdom, then it doesn't defeating that army doesn't necessarily win you a long-term victory. And that's the example. We'll talk a bit about how this conflict ended. I'll let Cale take over for a minute, and then we'll finish up. This, by the way, is the shrine where the Imam Ali is entombed.
So the battle went on for a few weeks between the... This feels like a presidential debate, only we're on the same side. It's kind of weird. So the battle went on for a few weeks, and there are snipers posted from both sides on both sides of the front line. The Americans are sort of in the majority of the city, and in the center around the shrine, inside the shrine, are the Mahdi army, and they're running around in the sort of catacomb or the little alleyways in the streets in the Medina. And most civilians got out early on in that period, but a few civilians hung back and tried to stay in their homes. So this is one of these civilians crossing the street between the battle lines between the Sadr militia in the interior of the city and the American side, and there's snipers on both sides sort of watching anyone who crosses this front line. And the Americans, of course, are trying to prevent more fighters from coming, but they've also left a little avenue, a little back door, so some fighters could leave. And we happened to find that avenue as we were moving around the city trying to get in. So their strategy was really to sort of dampen this thing out and overwhelm the fighters and get most of them to retreat. But in any case, this man is crossing that front line with his son and the kids, but just beside himself, because all night long there have been these terrifying bombings and, you know, planes that are used. They call them the spookies. They're these really loud, scary bombing planes that send lots of ammunition out at high speed. They're actually guns mounted inside the planes, the cargo planes. So the kids are just, this kid's terrified, and he's crossing that front line. This is what the fighters look like. I mean, these guys are like in flip-flops and in their, you know, tattered clothes, and they've been eating rice and potatoes for a couple of weeks, and they don't have the greatest weapons, but they were willing to take on the Americans. It was a really powerful moment of recognition for me to understand how far these people were willing to go to fight for the opportunity to fight. And the fact that they let me hang around and take these pictures was also shocking to me. But they understood the power of information. They really wanted their story told, as many people do. So there was finally, there was a negotiated peace between the two sides, and the Mahdi army agreed to surrender. And in the Americans' minds, I think they thought it was a sort of a victory because the Mahdi army surrendered. They turned in their weapons. They were supposed to turn in their weapons. They put them on carts, and they actually hauled them off and buried them other places. But at least they stopped fighting. And they went home, essentially, after some time. But what the catch here is that they, for them, in their minds, it was really a victory because they'd stood up to the Americans at all. And they had gained so much political credibility as a result of this standoff that the political party later gained a lot of support and actually managed to eventually become an officially recognized party and is now part of the Iraqi parliament based on this very interaction with the United States. So I think it's an example of how policy sometimes produces unexpected political results. When you confront people, they gain also a lot of strength. So in the days just after the tentative peace was made between these two groups, between the U.S. and the Mahdi militia, people just went around the city collecting the dead, and there was terrible devastation in the city as well. I mean, it was really torn apart. And this is a city that had been the site of pilgrimage and tourism, really, for Iraq, and had been a huge source of income and kind of a place of retreat for people. And the city was just demolished. It's since been has been rebuilt, but it took a long time, and many people lost their livelihoods through this. This is the market in Najaf after the battle. I think we're moving on to the last group of pictures here. Yeah, so this is one of Muqtada al-Sadr's posters in support of the militia group. Many people believe that this image here of the guy with the gun is actually Muqtada al-Sadr himself because he's kind of pudgy and he's got dark hair, but it's not him. But this was sort of distributed and meant to be him, and it's an example of how his profile was raised as a result of this standoff, this battle, because his leadership did bring them forward against the Americans. They really gained a lot of credibility during this time. And I don't think that Muqtada al-Sadr's group represents interests of everyone in Iraq, certainly. So powerful.
Just to be clear, this is a poster that was used in the first elections in Iraq in 2005. Now, this is just after this confrontation in Najaf that we showed you the pictures of. In sort of tactical terms, it was an absolute victory for the Americans. They killed more Mehdi army than Americans were killed, though some 60 Americans did die in the effort. So in a tactical sense, you know, they blew up more buildings, they killed more people. But this poster actually took that battle, and they said, look, we're the ones who stood up to the Americans. We are the martyred ones now. You know, vote for us. And they became the single largest party with representation in the parliament. And this is ostensibly the very people we did not want to put into power. And I think it's because we don't understand the social dynamics, or we're not willing to consider the local dynamics, that we make the sort of decisions that put the very people we don't want in power into power. And I guess in some way, we're not politicians. We're just photographers. But in a way, we want to do our part, if we can, to reorient that discussion and the view back to the local social dynamics of Iraq and to see things from that point of view. And that's really all that we have here. But we do want to, open up for some questions if you have them. But that's what we have for the presentation tonight.